From WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. Leonardo da Vinci, surely one of the most curious men recorded in history, would pursue a project just as long as it held his curiosity and then drop it for something entirely different. In his latest book, Why? What Makes Us Curious? Astrophysicist Mario Livio points to da Vinci as one avatar of curiosity and introduces us to many others. Curiosity is part of what makes us human, Livio says, and he points to a reason authoritarian regimes often try to repress curiosity. It is an antidote to fear.
We in particular fear things that we don't understand or don't know, and if we are curious enough to become familiar with those things, then fear actually tends to disappear.
It's On the Record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at wypr.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@wypr.org.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're On the Record. Summer is here. It's Memorial Day. Maybe your schedule is about to ease up, give you a bit of time to explore some interest that's been tempting you. Ever stop to think about why you're curious about some things and not others? Or why some people seem constantly to be asking, why is that? Is curiosity something you expect from children, but assume it dwindles as people age? Mario Livio asks all those questions and more in his book titled, Why? What Makes Us Curious? Livio's own life and career shows allegiance to curiosity. He's an astrophysicist who worked on the Hubble Space Telescope. He's written 5 other popular books on mathematics, biology, space, and chemistry. And he sometimes shares his scientific insights in artistic presentations, as with the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra. When we spoke last year, I asked why Livio thought the world needed a discussion of curiosity.
Well, you know, curiosity it drives almost everything we do. Think about this. I mean, you don't even want to be in a conversation with somebody if you're not somewhat curious about what she or he has to say. Not to speak of all forms of art, from films to books to plays to, TV shows and so on. And of course, science. Curiosity drives all scientific research. I mean, we want to know why and how all the time.
I think this book was just a ruse for you to have a reason to interview a whole bunch of interesting people. Like, you talked to Brian May, the guitarist, former guitarist of Queen, the rock group, who's now an astrophysicist, and you talked to Marilyn Vosavant, the high IQ columnist for Parade magazine. I mean, why did you need to talk to all those people? Why were you curious to talk to them?
Well, I was thinking about people who I regard as really curious. And of course, it's hard to know who is curious, and it's even harder to know about people you don't know very well if they are curious or not. But in the case, let's say, of Brian May, who, by the way, still is a guitarist for Queen because they sometimes still perform, even though in different types of formations.
Thank you for the correction.
So here is a person who is so well known as you know, this virtuoso guitarist. And at the same time, he does a PhD in astrophysics. He's interested in Victorian stereophotography. He's a big activist for animals. So, you know, somebody who dabbles in so many fields has to be curious.
That's interesting. You spend a big part of early in the book describing Leonardo da Vinci, who I think probably we would all assume was a curious guy. And you talk about the breadth of his interest, the breadth of his curiosity. Is that inherent in a really curious person, that they go very wide? Because one of the points you make about da Vinci is that he tended not to finish projects. He would get far enough into them to, I guess, figure he'd answered his questions, and then he'd drop it.
That's right. So his curiosity, basically, he stuck with the project for as long as he was still curious about it. Once he felt that he more or less satisfied his curiosity. He did not feel that he necessarily needs to finish a project, finish a painting, finish a sculpture, you know, and so on. I mean, once he figured out the questions he was really interested in, that was enough for him. But nonetheless, I mean, he has been called by others, not me, perhaps the most relentlessly curious person who ever lived. I mean, there is almost no field in which he wasn't interested.
But is that inherent in a really curious person that they have this very wide interest, or are some people curious in a deep, narrow way?
Yes, there are those as well, definitely. In particular, you know, some of my science colleagues and so on, they may be more curious in a deep, narrow way. But you see, sometimes it becomes hard at some point to distinguish between curiosity and what one might call drive. I mean, some people have a very strong drive. They have a drive to succeed in various ways. And that could be taken to reflect some form of curiosity, but it doesn't always. I mean, you know, somebody who wants to make lots of money, I mean, have a strong drive for that, and they may be getting very interested in how to make more money. Are they curious? Yes, at some level, but it's a different type of curiosity than people like Leonardo.
This is On the Record on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast, speaking with Mario Livio about his latest book, Why? What Makes Us Curious? Is curiosity the same as creativity?
No, it's not. Curiosity is apparently, psychologists have found, in particular, there is this Chicago psychologist, Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi, who interviewed about 100 very, very creative people. And he concluded that curiosity is absolutely necessary for creative people. But to be creative also means that, you know, you changed a particular domain or invented a new domain. So just being curious is not enough to be creative, but it appears to be necessary to being creative.
I've always thought of curiosity as joyful. But you describe some versions of it as generated by anxiety. Explain that.
That's right. So there is a very productive, he's a psychologist economist, George Lowenstein, who developed this information gap theory of curiosity.
Information gap.
Yes. Basically, what that says is that imagine that, you know something, but there is still something you don't know, and you feel that there is something that is still to be known there. So you feel that there is a gap in your knowledge about a particular subject, or that you encounter some things which disagree with your previous knowledge or previous biases, at least. And that situation, according to Lowenstein's theory, generates an aversive state, a state of unpleasantness, that, you know, you feel that you need to fill that gap. And that's what, in his theory, drives curiosity. So, yes, there is such a curiosity. I mean, I'm sure you have encountered these situations. For example, just to mention a very simple situation where you try to remember, so what is the name of that woman who wrote that book? And that can be really bothersome until you actually remember.
And that's curiosity?
Yeah, that is sometimes called specific curiosity, because in this particular case, you are interested in a very specific piece of information.
But that's a piece of information, the example you gave, a piece of information I had at one point. I think of curiosity as going off into the unknown.
Yes, so there is that too. I mean, there are various types of situations. So the one I just mentioned is called specific curiosity. Then there is a curiosity which has been dubbed perceptual curiosity. Perceptual curiosity is a situation where, you know, you encounter something that is very surprising to you, or something that is ambiguous, that you cannot somehow figure out whether it's this way or the other way. You mentioned the unknown. So think of these Asian children in a remote Tibetan village who see a white person for the first time. They are very curious about that. That's perceptual curiosity. Then there is the curiosity that drives scientific research. That has been dubbed epistemic curiosity, which means you want to understand how things work, why they are the way they are, and so on.
So perceptual, epistemic.
Specific.
And there's another one.
Diversive.
What is diversive curiosity?
Diversive curiosity is, you know, when you see young people constantly on their cell phone, you know, looking all the time for things to ward off boredom. You know, they look for, do they have a new text message? Do they have a new email? Or people who cannot wait for the new smartphone model to come out. You know, they read about this all the time and so on. So that's diversive curiosity.
Well, that seems very common in this day and age. Does one type of curiosity tend to elbow out the others, or do people follow all of them?
Yeah, and sometimes they even enhance each other. Yes, I mean, you know, you could start with even, you know, diversive curiosity where you browse the web just for nothing special, and then you suddenly hit on something which interests you, and, you know, you could become epistemically curious about this, or you want for a specific piece of information, so you have specific curiosity. I want to emphasize that these names, they were given by psychologist Daniel Berline. It's not a unique classification of curiosity. I would say the two types of curiosity that I really, you know, spent most of my time on are this thing which I call perceptual curiosity, which are those things that are ambiguous or surprising, as opposed to epistemic curiosity, which is that deep curiosity when you go deeply into something, do research about it, get involved in a lot of exploration and so on.
You include graphs that, if I understood them, show that we tend not to be curious about stuff we know nothing about at all, and not to be curious about things that we think we know well enough to know we're kind of bored with them. What is the sweet spot?
I cannot quantify it very well, but the thing is that if you look at our curiosity as a function of our knowledge, let's say, of a certain topic, or as a function of our uncertainty about a certain topic, then it looks like an inverted U shape, which means if you know absolutely nothing, then, you know, what are you going to be curious about? If you know a lot about this, then you think that whatever you don't know yet, you know, it's not worth bothering about. So you're really curious about those things that where you know something, but you have a strong feeling that there is more to be known. To use a phrase used by former Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, you are very curious about the known unknowns, namely those things that you know that you don't know. You are not particularly curious about things like known knowns, namely things you know.
And you're not curious about the unknown unknowns.
Well, you may be curious about unknown unknowns, but you're not sure what to do about it because they are unknown.
I mentioned as we started the idea that I think probably is in my head that curiosity is something that's very vibrant in children and tends to fade as we age.
That is a common perception because, you know, you encounter young children who keep asking why all the time, and you encounter less of that with adults. Studies show that this is true to some extent, but in particular with certain forms of curiosity. So it is true that children are very interested in the new, and they want to understand cause and effect around them. You know, they relatively early on seem to understand that every effect has some cause that is linked to that, and they want to understand those links. So they're perceptual curiosity, for example. They are surprised by lots of things or you know, feel ambiguous about things. So this is why they ask so many why. Adults, their epistemic curiosity, you know, they're love of knowledge and wanting to learn actually stays fairly constant, it turns out, during, you know, your adult life. But you are somewhat less surprised by things, and you are somewhat less willing to take risks, you know, for novelty as an adult.
Time for a quick break here on The Record. We're listening back to our conversation with astrophysicist Mario Livio about his book, Why? What Makes Us Curious? He's speaking about it tomorrow night at the Ivy Bookshop. I'm Sheila Cast. When we're back, we'll dip into the history of curiosity. If you're curious, stay with us.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking today about a driving force in human personality, a kind of hunger for knowledge that we seldom analyze. The drive is curiosity. The book we're discussing is Why? What Makes Us Curious? I spoke with its author, astrophysicist Mario Livio, when the book was published last summer and asked where curiosity comes from.
Well, I'm not sure if you mean where does it come from in terms of our physiology. Of course, it's in our brain. Or if you mean how did it evolve? And of course, it evolved at some level because there were questions we needed to answer for survival.
You make the point that it takes a certain amount of brain power, physical construction in the brain, to ask why. And you walk us through in your book the relevance of the way the brain developed in upright walking apes. Share some of that.
Right. So we are actually the only animal that asks why. I mean, there have been done experiments with chimpanzees, you know, which are very close to us. And while they are curious at some level, they are never actually interested in unseen reasons.
How do we know that?
So they did this fascinating experiment where they took 3 to 4 year old children and a bunch of chimpanzees, and they gave them a block in which they put weights in a funny way so that those blocks could not stand upright. And they asked the chimpanzees and the children, you know, to try to stand those blocks. Well, the children, about 60% of them, once they realized that they cannot make the blocks to stand, they took the blocks in their hand, inspected it visually, tried to touch it to understand, you know, why it wasn't standing. The chimpanzees, none of them ever did that. They just kept trying all the time.
So they didn't give up, but they didn't really try to solve the problem.
That's right.
You write about the way our brains are constructed, and you go off on what I thought was, do I really need to know this tangent, about the number of neurons. Can you give us a short version of that? Why that's important?
Well, it turns out that what really makes us different from anybody else is the number of neurons in our cerebral cortex.
First of all, what is a neuron in our brain?
A neuron is the unit of computation in our brain that does everything, you know, you want our brains to do. And until about a decade ago, we didn't have even precise numbers on the number of neurons in our cerebral cortex or the numbers of neurons in our brain, for that matter. And we now know it's about 86 billion. And it's about 3 times what the brain of an orangutan, say, has, which are very close to us in some sense. So what happens is that at a certain point, the brains of humans really took off, and, you know, suddenly, you know, until it reached this situation where we have 3 times more neurons than even close relatives.
And so it's because we have, Homo sapiens has that much more brain power that we can ask the why questions.
In our cerebral cortex, that's right. That's the crucial thing. That's where you know, all our consciousness lies.
I was interested in you also talk then about the energy that it requires to power
right.
that brain
right.
in addition to powering the body that contains it. And the role that cooking played
May have
in
played.
Evolution
yes. right.
to make sure we could get the energy we need.
Right. So our brain is very expensive in terms of its energy bill. Our brain consumes about 20 to 25% of the total energy that we consume, as opposed to other animals where the brain consumes only about 10%. And that's largely because we have this larger number of neurons. Now, cooking, this is a speculation. Not all researchers agree to this, but there has been a speculation that cooking helped us really get, you know, more bang for the buck, so to speak. Because with cooking, what happened was that we could eat foods we couldn't eat before. We could digest them more easily. We spent much less energy on just chewing and digesting our food
than we had
before.
You yes. say that we went from spending about 5 hours a day chewing to down to 1 hour a day
right.
chewing.
Right, and also different kinds of food. I mean, you know, they started eating meat. They started extracting bone marrow from bones and so on. So, yes, now I want to emphasize, not everybody agrees that cooking is as crucial as that, because they say that cooking actually came a little bit later. But all agree that cooking and the change into walking upright and the less intestine length and all that, all of those somehow combined together to actually increase the number of neurons in our cortex.
This is On the Record on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast, speaking with Mario Livio about his latest book, Why? What Makes Us Curious? About halfway through the book, I began to have this idea that I wondered whether curiosity is an indulgence. I mean, people who are living hand-to-mouth, people struggling to survive, do they really have the capacity to give play to curiosity?
They always are curious about something, but it is absolutely true that it changes substantially the types of things they are curious about. I mean, if you are really struggling to survive, or you're a refugee that has to cross borders on foot with your children, you don't have time to really contemplate the meaning of life or things like that. You're still curious about, where can I find the next food source or things like that. So it's not as if you lose your curiosity, but it definitely is channeled into other directions.
You write that curiosity often has not been encouraged by power.
That's true. I mean, you know, we know of the Middle Ages, of course, when Orthodox Church orthodoxy, you know, built certain walls around certain types of knowledge and basically tried to convince people that, we know enough and there is nothing more to be learned. We also know, unfortunately, even today, of various totalitarian regimes the Nazis had this degenerate art exhibit, they tried to say that modern art is just some plot against the German people, and they organized an entire exhibit that was supposed to turn everybody against that type of art. We know of book burning on various episodes throughout human history, and we know that people in ISIS have destroyed various history artifacts in Palmyra. So, yes, there have been many types of so-called guardians of the status quo who wanted to prevent people from being very, very curious. And I believe we actually have to fight this.
Yeah, you say, as you were contemplating that history, your own conclusion, curiosity is the best remedy for fear. Explain
I know.
That.
So, when you are curious, it means that this gives you this freedom to try to explore everything, as long as you don't infringe on other people's rights and you keep certain ethics. When you are very curious, even fear itself becomes just another topic to be investigated and understood. And that's what I mean. You know, we have long gone, are those days when FDR said, you know, we have nothing to fear but fear itself. Unfortunately, we fear lots of things today. But we in particular fear things that we don't understand or don't know or are unfamiliar. And if we are curious enough to become familiar with those things, then fear actually tends to disappear.
Well, I appreciate your exploring curiosity with us. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Mario Livio's book, Why? What Makes Us Curious? Has just been published in paperback. He's speaking about it tomorrow, 7 p.m. at the Ivy Bookshop on Falls Road. We'll have a link at the On the Record page at WYPR.org. Thanks for sharing part of your Memorial Day with us, this day when we honor those who died in military service to our country. This afternoon at 3 p.m., wherever you are, you're encouraged to pause for 1 minute, a national moment of remembrance. I'm Sheila Cast, back with you tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to this segment of On the Record with Sheila Cast. You can catch the show on the radio Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And you can support On the Record and all the other public radio programs that WYPR brings to you. Just click the donate link at the top of WYPR.org. And thanks.